The Gemara in Sukkah describes a very, very bitter, very, very hard eulogy. And the Gemara describes the Safta Aretz Mishpachos, all families will gather around, all peoples will gather and will cry a bitter, bitter eulogy. Rashi says the type of pain that a man feels upon losing his only son. And the Gemara describes, what is this eulogy about? What is this terrible crying, this terrible bitterness about? A Yetzahara Sheneharag, on the Yetzahara that is killed. The Gemara says, Hayaspeid by the Mevet, Simcha by the Mevet. What are you making a hesped for? If we're talking about the Yetzahara being killed, why are they crying? They should be laughing. They should be dancing in the streets. Kedarish Rabbi Huda, the Gemara answers, this is what Rabbi Huda was saying. Lossi Lovo, in times to come, when Mashiach comes, Mevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yetzahara, Hashem will bring the Yetzahara v'shachto, and Hashem will kill it. Hashem will destroy the Yetzahara. B'fnei HaTzadikim u'pnei HaRishayim, in front of the Tzadikim and in front of the Rishayim, and they will all witness the destruction of the Yetzahara. Tzadikim nidmelem kehar gavoa, to the Tzadikim he will appear as a mighty, powerful mountain. Vereshoyim, and to the wicked people, nidmelem kechut asara, he'll appear like a thin hair, like a hair from the head. Halalu bochim, valalu bochim, both groups cry. The tzaddikim cry, and the reshoyim cry. Tzaddikim bochrim, the tzaddikim cry, and they say, heich yuchlu nichvosh har gavoa, because how is it possible? How could we have fought against this mighty, powerful mountain? How could we have conquered him? The wicked people cry, V'omrim, they say, how is it possible that we couldn't win against this hair, this small little nothing? And even Hashem joins them in this tema, in this wonderment. And this is how the Gemara describes a very different time period than we live in now, a time period of understanding, a time period of truth, a time period of a brilliant light shining. The Yetzirah will be shechted, and everyone there will cry, but they'll cry because of very different images that they see, and they'll cry because of very different emotions. And the Tzaddikim will have this powerful, powerful tema. How is it possible that we conquered this mighty mountain? The Rishayim will say, how is it possible that we fell prey to this tiny little nothing, this hair? I'm Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says, Yetzahara, this is the nature of the Yetzahara. B'tchila dom melechut shabuchya. Initially, he appears as a thin spider web, nothing. U'l'besof dom lekavos agala. And in the end, he appears as a powerful rope that can tie an ox. He starts as a very thin hair and ends up as a powerful, powerful bond that ensnares you. And I believe it warrants us asking the following question on this Gemara. And that question is, the Tzaddikim see one image, the Rishayim see a different image, but the problem is, which one is correct? The Rishayim see the Yetzirah as this powerful mountain, inconquerable, huge, powerful. The Rishayim see him as a tiny little hare. The question is, which image is correct, which one's right? And to focus on what this Gemara really is sharing with us, I think we need to focus again a little bit about the role of the Satan and why Hashem created it. As I mentioned before, Hashem created us out of two different elements, Nefesh HaSichli, Nefesh HaMahami, in constant battle, constant challenge, constant fight. Hashem also implanted an imagination, a Koach HaDimyon, all of this to allow man free will. I don't have free will really to put my hand in a fire. In theory, I could, but I'm not really tempted. In theory, I could drink bleach, but I wouldn't. Hashem put man in a place to give man a perfect balance to allow him to actually choose. And therefore, Hashem created many different dimensions to allow man to be perfectly balanced in the middle. One, the balance between Nefesh HaSichli, Nefesh HaBahami. Two, imagination. And then the problem became that if man would choose properly, he would grow and accomplish, he would perfect himself, and within a short amount of time, the Nefesh HaSichli would be brilliant, would be clearly incisive in understanding, and he never would do things that are foolish, and therefore, again, he wouldn't have free will. And therefore, Hashem created the Satan. The Satan is the balancing agent. The Satan is allowed to function in exactly the amount to always keep an even playing field, so that the stronger the Nefesh HaSichli becomes, the more clearly I see the damage of any Avera, and the more clearly I see the benefit of any mitzvah, the more the Satan is allowed into the picture. Why? Because only then does it keep an even playing field. Only then does it keep things in balance. And the Satan is allowed to function in specific ways, in limited manners, always keeping it even, always keeping the playing field level. The Rambam describes what it's like in the times of Mashiach. The Rambam describes that the world will be basically as it is now, Olam b'minhag nohag. You'll still go to work, you'll still plant corn, you'll still harvest. The key distinction between now and the times of Mashiach is Molei Aretz Deyas Hashem. The entire world will be filled with the knowledge of Hashem. Bricks are solid. Ground is hard. I'm fully aware of these facts. I don't think them. I don't imagine them. I don't theorize them. I know them for a fact. If I never fell 45 feet to the concrete below, I know that it would damage me badly. In the time of Mashiach, like a brilliant sun at midday, lights up the world, and every human being recognizes there's a Borei Olam. Hashem created the world, Hashem maintains physicality, and Hashem orchestrates everything that occurs on the planet. But the point is that every human being sees this. Every human being sees with absolute clarity of thought that Hashem is here, present, engaged, running the world. And every human being sees behind the veil, sees behind the mist, and sees Hashem completely involved in the world right here on a daily basis. And immediately, every human being gets it. Every human being understands exactly why we were created. Every human being sees immediately the extraordinary value of a mitzvah, how it changes me and changes the world. And every human being recognizes the damage of an Avera, how it hurts me and damages the entire world. But it's everyone understands it, everyone gets it with absolute clarity, with absolute understanding. And I guess from that perspective, we could easily understand why the Rishayim cry. At that moment in time, they get it. What did I fall for? The Yetzer Hara came to me initially, it was like a little tiny spider web. Ask an addict the first time someone offered you marijuana or cocaine or whatever it was, could you have resisted? Of course I could have. Did you know it was bad for you? I guess on some level. But it didn't matter to me. And at that point, had the addict stopped, at that point, had the addict said, I want to fight this fight, it would have been simple as pie. There was nothing. He was pulled with the tiniest of threads, and he easily could have resisted. But he didn't. And he used the substance once, and he used it a second time, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and those spider webs started getting intertwined and doubled over, and more of them, and more of them. And if you've ever seen a powerful rope, a rope with which they tie up a horse, you'll see that it's only made up of many, many strands of thin, thin fiber. But if you take these very thin fibers and double them and redouble them, double them again and redouble them again, before you know it, it gets thicker and thicker, and the man is bound up in powerful, powerful ropes that contain him that he can't escape. And all the while he doesn't realize it, and all the while he doesn't understand it, until he's bound head to foot and he can't escape. And in one fell swoop, with one brilliant sunrise, the Rishayim get it. I gave up my future. I gave up happiness. I gave up eternity for what? For nothing. It was a spider web. It was a tiny little fiber. And I'm the one who made it stronger and stronger. Time after time, I gave in. Time after time, I caved. And I was the one who caused this. And the Rishayim cry, and it's very obvious why they cry, because in that moment they recognize and they say to themselves, fool that I was. What was my problem? Why didn't I wake up? Why didn't I realize what I was getting into? And so from that perspective, I guess it's rather obvious why the Rishayim cry. They at that moment recognize the truth, realize what it is that they gave up life for, and they feel a bitter, bitter crying, tearing eulogies. But the question then is, so what do the Tzaddikim cry for? And why do the Tzaddikim see him not as that very thin spiderweb, but as this powerful mountain? Why did Rishayim have a different understanding and a different view at that moment? And to understand the answer to this question, I believe we need to focus a little bit on the concept of nisyonos, but not a personal nisayon, the nisayon of a generation. You see, each generation has its tests, each generation has its difficulties. In some generations, the fight is about money. In some generations, the fight is about social pressure. In some generations, there are various forces. Each generation has its winds that blow, social forces, societal pressures, different things that become the nisayon of the generation. Not long ago, in the United States of America, the fight of the generation was money. If you landed on these shores in the 1920s and you were dirt poor, but poor meant you literally had no food to eat, poor meant you didn't know how you were going to pay your mortgage, and you were offered a job, but of course that job meant you had to work on Shabbos, that was a mighty nisayon. My father told me that the Hashkama minyans began because people wanted to go to daven on Shabbos before they went to work. They had to be at work at 9, so the only way they could daven on Shabbos with a minyan was to have Hashkama minyan, and so they began early minyanim on Shabbos so that the men could daven with a minyan and then go off to work. He also told me that there was a kiddush that men would make when they retired, because when they were 65 or 70, whatever the age was, and they retired, then they could again keep Shabbos. It was a very, very difficult nisayon in America in the 20s and the 30s. And for the record, it was also a difficult nisayon in Europe. The average balabas would have loved his child to be a Talmud Chacham. The average balabas would have loved his Shloimi or Yosef to go to yeshiva, but who in the world could afford it? And certainly by the age of 13, the average boy was working, and often way before that. In America, at the age of 6, boys would be riding on the back of milk trucks to gather pennies, that they would help the fellow unload the milk. If you remember the Triangle Fire in New York City, the beautiful triangle building in Manhattan caught fire and hundreds of children were killed. Why? Because the sweatshops were manned by children. The foreman would lock the door at the start of the day so that the kids wouldn't leave their sewing machines. And when the fire broke out, they were killed because no one could escape. But here was the point. It was a regular thing for children to work. Child labor laws came into force in America long after that. But for many, many years, for decades, one of the great fights for a person to be a Torah true Jew, certainly to be a Talmud Chacham, was the challenge of money. You couldn't afford to earn a living. In other generations, there were different challenges. In Europe, once upon a time, there was a challenge called the Enlightenment, where intelligent, talented young men would leave the Beis Medrash not to earn a living, but to learn about the deep understandings of the world, the deep lures of science, the deep lures of history, of a liberal education. Rav Elchanan Wasserman used to read the newspaper in the Beis Medrash before Seder. One time he found his newspaper confiscated and it was brought to the Hanhala. And he walked into the member of the Hanhala's office and he said, first of all, v'heshiv es agzela, I want the stolen object returned. My newspaper was stolen from me. And second, Rav Elchanan said, I think it's important for every Jew to read the newspaper daily and to chaz hashas at least once a year. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was not an enlightened fellow, but some other fellow in the yeshiva saw this bacher, saw him reading a newspaper and assumed he was from the Haskalah, from those who valued secular knowledge to the extent that it overshadowed Torah, that they would run away from the Beis Medrash. And there was a huge movement in parts of Europe to leave yeshiva, to leave Torah for the lure of secular knowledge. As an interesting aside, I was at a shiva house. And at the shiva house, I heard a story that was absolutely mesmerizing. Rabbi Gold was a Rav in Worcester, Connecticut. And as part of his job as Rav, he would visit an old age home in the town. And he became friendly with a woman there who was an older woman in the home. And they would talk. One day this woman says to Rabbi Gold, you know, you're a rabbi. Happens to be my brother also became a rabbi. What a mind he had. Brilliant, brilliant mind. My brother Aaron had such a mind. He could have been one of the greatest mathematicians in all of Europe. He could have been a sterling light. But he got ruined. He had this friend Reuven. And this friend Reuven ruined him. What did he become? He became nothing. He became a rabbi. He opened a yeshiva somewhere in New Jersey. And the world could have known of him. And no one knows of him. Now, Rabbi Gold was a little bit curious because this woman was describing a time period when there were very, very few yeshivas and certainly very, very few in New Jersey. So Rabbi Gold asked, excuse me, what was your maiden name? Cutler. And your brother's name? Aaron Cutler. Why? Have you heard of him? And now I'll share with you the story. The Alt of Slobodka received the letters from Aaron Cutler's older sister who was in university, and Aaron Cutler's older sister was trying to influence him to leave yeshiva and pursue a secular career. The Alta, recognizing the danger, put this young Aaron Cutler together with Reuven Grinovsky, who was older, as an older influence, and in fact, Aaron Cutler remained in yeshiva and became Rav Aaron Cutler Gadol Ador, the Torah giant. But this was the point. As a young boy, it wasn't that obvious. As a young boy, it wasn't so simple. There was a lure. There was an appeal. There was a great desire to be like the others, and this enlightenment pulled. And each generation has its pull. In some generations, it's tremendous needs to be like the people amongst whom we live. In some generations, there's tremendous needs to make money. In some generations, there's tremendous pulls, social winds that blow. What's interesting to note is that none of them apply to us. We live in a very different world. In our world, we're given tremendous cover for learning. Who wouldn't want their son to be a Talmud Chacham? Who wouldn't want their daughter to marry a person of stature? By and large, we have money. I don't know of the young man who at 13 years of age had to leave yeshiva to go work. I don't know the young man who at 18, nor at 24. We live in a world of ashiras, and we live in a world where there's tremendous, tremendous kavod given for learning. So many guys remain in yeshiva when they shouldn't, just so they can get a good shidduch. And we live in a world that we've created a Torah environment where Torah flourishes, and Torah remains supreme. So the question is, what's the sign of our generation? We're not pulled out of the Beis Medrash to become secular scientists. We're not pulled out of the Beis Medrash because we have to earn a living. What pulls us out? What is the sign of our generation? And I'd like to share with you, it shouldn't be a great secret, but I'll give you an illustration as to what is the fight of our generation. When I take my kids to the zoo, I fully expect that the behemoths behind the bars should be naked because they're animals. Animals are supposed to run around naked. What's surprising is that the people on the other side of the bars also run around naked. Men and women today run around like Adam and Chava before the Chet. And if you look at the way that people, sane people, rational people, sophisticated people dress, they dress as if there was no sanity left in the world. And I'd like to share with you that this isn't the way it used to be. And if you look at pictures from America in the 1920s and the 1930s, people dressed as people are supposed to. As a matter of fact, if you look at a picture of a woman from the 20s, you'll see that the sleeves go down to the wrist and the skirts go down to the ankle. It was considered rude for a woman to show up in public with her ankle exposed. They make our frumest Beis Yaakov graduates today embarrassed by the tznius that they had. And these were the average people, regular people 80 years ago in this country dressed with a tremendous sense of propriety. And if they didn't have natural tznius, believe me, their fathers or the husbands would never let them out in the streets dressed anything but properly. What kind of family are we? You're going to dress that way? What's wrong with you? I don't mean to be humorous, but I'll say it. There used to be a woman who was a prostitute, a zona, and it was very clear what she did for a living. She dressed the part. Everyone knew what she did for a living. Everyone knew who she was. I have a question. How do you advertise today? I'm the real McCoy. No, I really am. I'm a zone. Really am. No, really. They all, excuse my expression, dress that way. And the problem is, how do you say that you're really in business? And this wasn't the way it used to be. My mother was brought up in Brooklyn, New York. My grandfather was a regular balabas. At 18 years of age, my mother came back with lipstick on and she got a frosk and punim, she got a potch. How dare you, a Jewish girl, go out on the street with lipstick at your age? It's not becoming. There was a sense of propriety, a sense of normalcy. Women dressed like they were supposed to be respectable, respected. In the 1920s, Lane Bryant was a maternity clothing wear manufacturer, and they wanted to take out an ad in the New York Times, and the New York Times refused. Can't show a picture of a pregnant woman in the New York Times. A pregnant woman dressed in a very tsunua manner was not accepted in the New York Times because it was too prust, too vulgar. We can't show that publicly. It's not refined. I assure you, the New York Times today has no problem with Lane Bryant taking out ads in it. And in a very, very short time, what was considered normal and sane has not just gone out the window, but has become so foreign that the average person doesn't even recognize it. What you see today passing for normal behavior is so insane and so deviant that you can't compare it to 50 years ago and surely not 100 years ago in this country. And let me give you an illustration of what I mean. Herbert Hoover began the Federal Communications Commission. This was in the 1920s when radio became popular in this country, and the role of government was to protect its people. And for that reason, Herbert Hoover began the FCC to protect innocent women, children, and men who'll be in their homes listening to the radio, and there might be things that they shouldn't hear. And his words when he began the organization was, the government has a special responsibility to double safeguard its members. And with that, the FCC was started. originally over radio to protect regular people. Then when movies became popular, they had ratings. And the ratings were very, very strict. If the cowboy put both hands on his hips and used a seven-letter word that got an R rating, which meant restricted, this is not for the average audience. Your child should not be seeing this. Your child should not be exposed. It's 17 years of age minimal, and then with parental supervision, we want you to understand that your child should not be seeing this unless you're really convinced that he can handle it. That's not quite the movie ratings today. What passes for normal conduct on the movies, on TV, on the airways today is beyond description. On a regular basis, if you turn into rap radio stations, you'll hear songs about killing your girlfriend, killing the police, the beauty of heroin. Everything that's deviant, everything that's abhorrent is sung about. If those songs were broadcast 50 years ago in the United States of America, the FBI would have surrounded the station, they would have arrested the producer, and they probably would have shot the singer. Because those words aren't normal. Cop killing is not something that should be sung about on public radio. It's not something that's healthy, not something that's regular, not something that's normal. And I'll share with you a statistic. I don't know if I need to inform you, but just as an observation. Studies show that the average child watching TV today will see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation a year. Now, cohabitation is a very fancy word for znus. That means a man and a woman living together. The average child watching TV will see thousands upon thousands of acts of cohabitation, only one in seven of those acts being between a husband and his wife. So let's do the math. Of the thousands upon thousands of acts that young Peter, Paul, or Mary will see, only one in seven is between a husband and his wife. Now, what 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds are doing watching a husband being intimate with his wife, I don't know. And I sure question whether it's good for their psyche, whether it's good for their development, whether it helps them to be wholesome, well-developed children. But the observation is that it's only one out of seven that's between a husband and his wife. What are the 6 out of the 7? I guess between a husband and someone else's wife, and between a husband and a single woman, between a husband and a husband, a wife and a wife, and who knows, whatever. It's okay. It's all good. It's all out there for your child, adolescent, or whoever to see. And if you don't think that this has a very real effect and a very real damaging result, I'll share with you an observation that a friend of mine told me. I was very friendly with a child psychiatrist, and he described to me the following. He said that his practice is very interesting, because he said in America, it used to be that you had two parents who had 8 children. But nowadays, the people that he sees, it's 8 parents and 2 children. And explain what happens. Bob and Sally get married and have 2 kids. Well, Bob and Sally get divorced, and they each get remarried. So now we have 4. And then the second marriage falls apart. Now the 4 becomes 8. By the time the children make it into his practice, there's the first set of parents, the second marriage, the third marriage, and little Tom and little Sally have to describe to him what it's like growing up in this house and that house and switching in this house to Tuesday night, this house to Monday night. Then my wife just got divorced and she's getting remarried to the second and the third. And little children are exposed to things that are not helpful. Hashem created man and woman to get married, for a man to have eyes for his wife, to love his wife, to have a beautiful, happy home, and bring children up in that happy environment. And that was the United States of America until the 1950s. If you look at the old black and white movies, Watch a movie from the 40s or the 50s, and what you see is it was a home in the suburb with a picket fence, and there was a mother and a father and children. The family unit was intact. The parents, by and large, loved each other. The children, by and large, were brought up in happy homes. And those days are gone. We're dealing with way above a 50% divorce rate, but that's not the point. The point is that what has become accepted as normal behavior in our society is so abnormal, so deviant, that it's difficult to even remember what normal used to look like. In the early 60s, in the Midwest, the Bible Belt, there were rallies when the Beatles were becoming popular. In these towns, they created burning Beatle record rallies. The people of the town, gathered by the minister or the fathers of the area, would gather together. They'd bring in the Beatle records and they'd burn them. And you could see pictures today of Beatle records being burnt. And do you know why? Because the Beatles, as a rock group, were considered abhorrent and deviant. They came out with lines that were way too racy. Lines about, I want to hold your hand. Things that were just not the kind of thing you want your kids to hear. That's not what rock musicians are blamed for anymore. Society as a whole has become so decrepit, so deviant, so rotten at the very essence of its core that it's hard to even remember how normal it used to be. And I'd like to share with you what you see today when you walk in the streets is not normal. When women walk around naked, stark naked, and if not stark naked, wearing something but little, that's not self-respect. That's not elegant. When husbands let their wives run around that way, and when fathers let their daughters go out that way, there used to be a sense of sobriety, of normalcy. There used to be a sense of we're dignified people. My daughter, for a living, is not in that red light district. That's not what she does for a living, and I don't let her dress that way. But that concept is so far gone and so far removed, the world we live in has become insane to the extent that you can't even talk to anyone. The fathers of this country were great human beings who had a sense of vision, had a sense of understanding. And I believe that if you were to bring them up today, bring up Jefferson, Washington, and bring up Franklin, and let them look at what's here today, they would scream out. They're probably rolling over in their graves because they created a country, the sense of morality, the pursuit of happiness within the sense of a dignified, respectable society. And in an amazingly short time, that has disappeared. America was a Puritan country. America was the height of virtue. America was a country that lived with such extreme tsnius. And in but a heartbeat of time, it's disappeared. In the 1960s began the countercultural revolution. And within a heartbeat of time, everything that was normal and regular has been destroyed. And mankind and society is not better for it. And if you'd ask anyone with wisdom, anyone with das, is this good for society? Is it good to have something like the family destroyed? Is it good for a child to know that his parents, if they are married, aren't going to be likely married for another year or two or whatever? Is it good for wives to know that their husbands are just here for a little while? It's a start of marriage and he'll have eyes to somebody else and be there and whatever. Anyone with das, with wisdom, understands that it's destructive to civilization. So here's the question. Wouldn't you imagine that the government, congressmen, senators, who are wise people, who are civil servants, who are concerned for the good of America, wouldn't you imagine that they get up there and scream, what are you doing? That's what America did for decades. the government was there to safeguard its children. That's what institutions were. That's what schools represented. And I'd like to share with you that what you're looking at today is an anomaly, a very strange metzias, very, very unusual. And what you're looking at is a maisa satan. You see, today there is no fight. There's plenty of money, plenty of freedom. There's a Torah culture. And if you'd like to know what the fight of our generation is, it's in one area. It's in the area of Taiva in Arias. And the satan is let out of the box. You see, he can't fight in any other arena. He has no shlita, no control over anything else. And he's allowed full rulership in this area. And what you're looking at is a miracle. You should recognize it as so unusual. The decline of American morality happened in such a short time and such an amazing way that it is in the category of miraculous. We normally think about miracles as great things. Hashem involved in the world to protect us. Hashem is very involved. And the Satan is given control of certain areas for certain reasons. But that's exactly what's happening. And if you'd like to understand the answer to the tzaddikim, why they cry, it's because I don't care who you are, there's an awful lot of noise in this world we live in. There's an awful lot of static. You know, when you're on that plane to Israel for 11 hours, you don't even know, you don't even recognize how noisy it is. The plane lands and they shut the jets off and there's silence. But it's silence that you could feel, that you could, wow. When Mashiach comes and that brilliant light shines, the tzaddikim look back and they say, oh my goodness, that Russia, that wicked one was there bothering me and troubling me. I couldn't get in my car and drive down the highway without billboards smashing me over the... I couldn't not look because I crashed into another car. And there she was. And there was that image. And they find the most clever ways to make you look at what you don't want to look at. They find the most clever, ingenious methods to get you to do what you don't want. And in that one moment of clarity, the tzaddikim say, oh my goodness. And they look back on their life. And Rashi says, because they look back on their life and they get it, they begin crying because they remember the tsar and the tremendous pain that was caused by this Russia, by the satan. They remember it all. They feel it all. And they cry bitter tears over, as if it was a only child that was lost, a horrible eulogy. And I think that this Rashi is very, very important to understand. Because even if you are a tzaddik, and even if you're a kaddish v'tohar, you're going to have a lot of battles, and you're going to have a lot of fights. And there are going to be a lot of times when you have to pull back and resist, and you're going to fight and fight and back and forth and back and forth. And that's assuming that you're a tzaddik. And it's assuming that you're actually way out of the normal pulls of this generation. But if you're not quite a tzaddik yet, I guarantee that it's going to be a very, very bitter, very difficult battle. And what the tzaddikim see at that moment is how pervasive, how involved he was there all the time. And there's a certain reality. You cannot walk out in the streets. You cannot open a paper. You can't go onto an internet site anywhere without the dangers and the damage being right there. When I was a bachur in yeshiva, I remember the yeshivas that Tzal used to say, the only place that's safe are the Arba Kosli HaBeis Medrash. And even today, they're probably not even safe anymore. There's Wi-Fi. And Wi-Fi means there are no walls. And it's wherever you go, anywhere and everywhere, it's there. Mayasa ben Valeachta, how are you ever going to win this fight? He's always there. There are always images and always people and always things that you don't want to see. And you don't want to be involved in, but they're there constantly. And I guess probably the first chiddush we have to recognize is that this is remarkable. This is not normal. The world has lost its sense of sanity, and it's not by accident. And this is an act of the satan. And if you have trouble believing this stuff about, you know, angels and control and all this stuff, just study history. Look back at the way society was and look in but a heartbeat of time how quickly it changed and how different it is. But the Marshal makes a very interesting observation. He says, but still, why did the tzaddikim now see him as this powerful mountain? I understand why they feel the pain. They now see the amount of trouble that he gave them during their lifetime. And they didn't realize it while they were alive. They didn't realize it before Mashiach came, because like that noise on the jet, it's there, it's there, it's there, but you don't hear it. But now Mashiach comes in a brilliant shining light, they get it. So I understand why they cry. But still, why do they see the image as a har, as a mountain? And the Moshe says something so powerful. He says, because that's how the tzaddikim won the fight. You see, you know why the tzaddik doesn't get involved? Because he says to himself, I know the trick. Now it doesn't seem so dangerous. Now it doesn't seem so harmful. He's asking me to do one little thing, no big deal, but I know what it leads to. This thread becomes thicker, and then another thread is added, and another thread, doubled and redoubled again, until I'm going to be bound to my chair with thick, heavy irons. And because the tzaddikim know the result, they look into the future, and they say, I get your tricks. Now it's so easy to resist, but if I give in, it's going to be a powerful, powerful rope. And they look at the sof davar, they use their wisdom to see where this will lead, and they see where the Sutton ends up in the end. You see, if you give in, you will be faced with a mountainous giant you'll never be able to resist. But because the tzaddikim get that, they use that image, they bring up that reality when he first comes to them, and because of that, they're able to resist. If I had one wish, my wish would be to go to every young bachur before he reached maturity, physical maturity, and give him over the sense of what the 18-year-old or the 20-year-old feels like when he's really battling the battle. And every one of them says, when it first got involved, it was so innocent. It was an image or a picture or a movie or whatever. And of course I could have resisted. And had I known then the pain that I have now, in a million years I never would have done it. But I didn't realize then. It was cute. It was innocent. It was a friend of mine said, let's do this or let's look at that or whatever. And before you knew it, I'm here. And the amount of pain that a guy has when he's 18 or 20 or 24 or 30, when he's got to battle that battle, when he comes to a sense of das and recognizes that he's losing his life, that his life is Gehenim, because he has images and desires that he doesn't want, and he's got to battle those battles. And then he says, oh my goodness, I could have prevented this. I didn't have to look at those magazines or those sites or whatever it was. If I could give over to a young bachur, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, that image, and let him know, and this will be you. Your choice now, it seems so innocent, and it's so easy to resist. And if you don't resist it, you're going to end up there, ruining the day that you caved. But unfortunately, we human beings are all the same. I think the expression is that the average person thinks he's smarter than the average person, and you'll tell it to a 12-year-old, and they'll say, yeah, right, that's frum talk, that's rabbi talk, yeah, come on, this is not really usser, this is not really a problem, whatever. And he'll do whatever, and get involved in whatever, and he'll find himself years later with deep, deep regret, powerful, powerful regret. And again, if I had a wish, I would convey it. And for the record, if you have the capacity, if you have someone's ear, whether it be a younger brother, whether it be a fellow in a high school or maybe in grade school, and you could let him know this message, it may be the greatest chesed you could ever do for a guy. And let him know that it's so innocent now. It seems so simple, but it's an addiction. It will get into you and it'll get into you and into you, and you're going to be bound up. It always starts as a very thin little spider web. But just listen to the stories of guys who are in it and are battling the battles to get out and they're fighting Gehenna to get out. That pain doesn't have to be. And if you can convey that pain to a young bacher before he's in, it's a tremendous, tremendous chesed and tremendous favor that you can do for him. And I think what this chazal is offering us is an eye glimpse into reality. We're very, very caught up in the here and now, and we don't recognize it. What chazal are telling us is that there'll be a very different perspective that every one of us will have on reality. When that day comes, the Rishayim will cry bitter tears. What was my problem? What was I thinking? How could I have been so foolish? But more than that, what did I gain? Was I happier? Did I lead a better Olam Hazeh? Was my life better? America today is not a happy civilization. People today don't brag about their level of happiness, their level of enjoyment. They're running and running and running and running, consumed. And the level of depression is at an all-time high. The amount of antidepressants that are prescribed in this country on a yearly basis are unprecedented. Tens of millions of reported cases of clinical depression. But why? We have money. We have freedom. We have everything you could imagine. And the average person today is empty at his core and running after desire and honor and empty. Running after it didn't make him happy. It destroyed a society and took a civilization that was proper, holy, and laid it to waste. And you're looking at a Maisa Satan. And when Mashiach comes and that brilliant sun rises and we all see it, and the Rishayim will cry bitter, bitter tears. How could I have been so foolish? I didn't gain in this world and I wasted my world to come. I blew my eternity. And the tzaddikim also cry because they remember the pain. At that moment, they get it. They see he was gnawing at me, bothering me, bothering me. And he wouldn't let up. He never stopped. In the Beis Medrash, I couldn't run away. In the shuls, I couldn't run away. In the streets, wherever I was, he was bothering me with images and sights and scenes. And at that moment, they get it. And it's a bitter, bitter hesped and a bitter, bitter time. But I want to close with one last thought. You see, the Mashal learns his Gemara differently. The Mashal says, I can't accept what Rashi's saying. Because I understand that the Rishayim see him then, and they see that they wasted their lives, and they cry. Because they look back at what they could have been, and they see that they gave it all up for nothing, and of course they cry. But at this moment in time, granted the Tzaddikim see the pain that they suffered, but how could they cry? They've mastered. They reached heights. Mashiach is here. Everyone recognizes what a person can accomplish. And the tzaddikim are on top. They've grown. They've fought the fight. And the more they see how much of a battle it was, the happier they should be that they've vanquished him, that they've won the war. Says the Mashiach, how could it be that they're crying a hesped? A hesped means they're really sad. Not tears of joy. Tears of sadness. And I want to share with you how the Mashal learns his Gemara. He asks a very profound question. And that is, what does Hashem do that's bad? What does Hashem do that's evil? What does Hashem do that's vindictive, that's cruel? And the answer, of course, is nothing. Everything that Hashem does is for the best. Hashem is the meitiv. Hashem is the giver. And when Hashem created the Satan, it wasn't because Hashem was punishing man or putting obstacles in his way. It wasn't because the archangel got out of control and evil began spreading against God's will. Hashem created the Satan for a very specific and exact purpose, and that is to challenge man, to allow man to reach new heights, to allow man to reach heights that otherwise he couldn't reach. And if you'd like to understand the Satan a little bit better, imagine you have a personal trainer. And this guy's job it is to help you grow. by setting the bar a little bit higher and a little bit higher and a little bit higher. And every day he's there to challenge you. And every day he's there to make it a little bit more difficult. But because of that, you grow. And I'll share with you a mashal that I think very well encapsulates this. A number of years ago, I pulled out my back, and a friend of mine said, come to the gym. There's this coach there. He's a real pro. He'll put you back together. So I went, and he showed me how to power lift. And the coach was a very, very focused fellow, very much into the art and the science of powerlifting. And he showed me the exercise, and he worked with me. And it was really interesting to watch the coach because he was very, very into his malacha. In any case, I'd been doing it for a while. I was a Rebbe in the high school then. And there was a fellow in the kollel who also wanted to work out. And he said to me one day, would you take me to the gym? And I said, sure. Now, as a kid, I was very involved in sports. I was very involved in different things. So for me, going to the gym wasn't foreign. And right away, I picked it up. Right away, I was familiar with the various exercises. And I picked it up very quickly. This fellow in the kollel was, we call a very yeshivish fellow. Didn't play ball as a kid. Never lifted weights. And the minute I brought him into the gym, the coach realized that, oh, we got something over here. But he was a very sincere fellow, this coach, and he took this yeshivish fellow under his wing. And he worked with him every day, and he worked with him very closely. He showed him how to grip the bar, how to move, how to hold his hips, how to go through whole motion. And he worked with him for a number of weeks, and this fellow started getting pretty good. He started getting the motions, and coach started putting on more weights, and he started increasing and got better and better. After about 2 months, the yeshivish fella said to me, at some point, he said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with that coach. Every time I get the motion right, he goes and puts more weight on the bar. What's wrong with him? What did it hit him? Nar. Progressive weight training is about increasing the load on the body. The more weight you put on the bar, the more the body is challenged, the more the body is forced to respond, the stronger the body gets. If you'd like to understand the sutton, he is a personal coach, and he's there to make the bar heavy, just heavy enough that you can lift it, not too heavy that you can't lift it, but surely not too easy for it to be simple. And he's there all day, every day, making sure that you work, making sure that you're challenged, making sure that it's difficult, just barely doable. And if you keep winning and keep winning, you grow and you grow. The Moshe says, that's pshat in the tzaddikim. At that moment of clarity, they get it. Oh my goodness, look what I became. I only became it because of the sutton. I only became it because we lived in such a difficult generation. The heights that I reached, I can never reach again. It's different times now. Everyone understands the value of a mitzvah. Everyone understands the damage of avera. There's no huge growth that we went through then. The times that we lived before in are gone. In those times, we could reach stellar heights in but a moment. We were challenged, and the sutton was always there. The sutton was always there to force us to grow. And explains the mashal, the reason why the tzaddikim cry is because they realize how valuable the sutton was, and how awesome the times that they lived in were, because they were so black and so dark, and the challenges were so great that the tzaddikim reached tremendous, tremendous heights. And I believe that, Marsha, is critical for us to understand. We live in very difficult times. We have lots of money, lots of freedom, tremendous opportunities. And the sultan is there day in, day out to bother us and nag us. And on the one hand, our attitude should be, Russia, I hate you. And on the other hand, our attitude should be, wow, he's my best friend. Because of this matzav, I'm challenged. And I will not win every battle, but I'm going to win some. And when I win, what a victory it is. And when I win that fight, wow. And look what I've done. I vanquished myself. I gained control. But you're going to fail in an hour. And you'll fail tomorrow. It doesn't matter. Right now, I won this battle. And because of that, I grew. And because of that, forever, I have eternity. I have Olam Haba. And while we have to focus on these unusual times, that this is not normal, and the depravity that we see in the streets is not what's considered rational human behavior, and we also have to recognize that the sultan is, on the one hand, apparently evil, we also have to recognize that he's our best friend. And these situations that we're dealt with are great for us. The bar is constantly loaded with more weight than more weight, and when you become stronger, it's going to be even heavier. but that's going to force you to grow. And that's going to allow you to reach heights. And that's going to allow you to become someone who's great. And it could be when Mashiach comes, you'll stand towering over other people, towering huge and high, because you fought those fights, you battled those battles, and you reach heights that no one else could ever reach in previous generations, maybe in future. May Hashem grant us the wisdom to understand this. May we quickly usher in Mashiach Tzidkenu.